It is now my honor to introduce Timothy Snyder. This year, he became Richard C. Levin Professor of History of Yale University. He's written 6 books and participated in 2 others. One of his books, Bloodlands, has been translated into 33 languages, and that's just, I think, a few more than the number of languages he reads and speaks. His next book is The Road to Unfreedom, which will come out in April. His Facebook post after the presidential election expressing alarm and noting similarities to the 1930s went viral. He expanded it into his book on tyranny. He has lectured in many cities and countries about it, has appeared in many videos and on major TV programs, and recently, as was noted, started a YouTube channel simply named Timothy Snyder. It's been now a year since his Facebook posts. We've seen the Trump administration in action. Today, Democracy Now! Talked about the J20 protesters on trial for alleged conspiracies that could get them 60 years in jail. Overseas, we've seen a huge rally in Poland whose participants openly chanted the vilest slogans, and we see the near certainty that an ultra-right immigrant-hating party will be part of the next Austrian government. And as former Gandhi Peace Award winner Bill McKibben has reminded us, we're living through a year where America saw in California the largest fire in living memory and storms with the worst sustained winds, the heaviest rains, all at record levels. Fuel for a demagogue to spread refugee or ecological panic. Serious times we're living in. We're most eager to hear Professor Snyder's insights this evening.
Okay, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Introductions. It's a great pleasure to be here among you real people who have chosen to spend a couple of hours out with other real people. I want to thank Stanley especially for the mention of climate. The book before On Tyranny, the last scholarly book I wrote, was called Black Earth, and it was, among other things, a piece of environmental history which made claims about the relationship between the last globalization and this globalization and the possibility that climate change could create conditions which might make genocide more likely. When I published that book in 2015, I assumed that that was both the darkest book and the most political book that I would ever write. That quickly proved not to be the case. I very much share the broader concern about how environmental history creates conditions that will make tyranny more likely. Those are the kinds of things we have to be working on now, even as we're working on other things. This little pamphlet on tyranny is about what to do now. It's about the politics of the moment. And in speaking about it this evening, I in no way mean to displace the politics of the years to come and the politics of the next generation. I think about this little book as being about treading water. It's good to know how to swim, but before you know how to swim, you have to learn how to tread water. If this republic is going to be a better republic, this republic has to sustain itself, has to somehow survive the next few years. That's what this book is basically about. A source of pleasure for me is to be associated with the group which gave Ralph Nader an award. A couple of weeks after I published On Tyranny, I spoke to Ralph Nader for about 2 hours about it, which was a source of enormous pleasure for me because it's the only time I ever heard Ralph Nader happy. Oh. I don't know how many of you have listened to this discussion that I had with Ralph Nader, but I was in California, like wearing a bathing suit, lying on my back in some grass, listening to Ralph Nader be happy about someone having done something. And so I thought, okay, if nothing else happens as the result of this book, I have made Ralph Nader happy. Right? I have heard Ralph Nader smile over the phone. I've heard him laugh over the phone. Something has happened. So What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk through the book, talk through its lessons, and make a few remarks about what has happened in the year since the book came out, and a few remarks about how these general recommendations might be made a little bit more specific for the time we're in. So what is the book? Very importantly, the book is a text. It's a text. It's a book. It's something that's meant to be read offline. That seems like a very simple thing, but it's not. Stanley's right, the thing started as a Facebook post, but my whole attitude towards the internet is that the internet is only valuable insofar as it gets us to do things in the real world. If the internet makes us do more internet, that is almost always reactionary. It's almost always innovating and disruptive. It almost always gives us the sense that we're doing something when in fact we're not doing very much. The internet has to get us back out into the world. I just happened to be reading T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men from 1925, which has the famous lines, you know, between, how's it go? Between the motion and the act lies the shadow. When I read that now in 2017, I think of the shadow of the monitor of our computers. I think of the shadow as the 11 hours a day the average American spends in front of a screen. And I just can't help but think if that 11 hours were just 9 hours or even 10 hours and 45 minutes, the outcome of the last election would have been different. We would be living in a different place if we just spent a little bit more time with one another. I think a lot of politics or a lot of where we are comes down to this. So it's a text. It's a pamphlet. It's not a history book. As Stanley was kind enough to mention, I've written lots of long history books. So those of you who have an appetite for that sort of thing, I'm happy to try to fulfill it, you know, at length with multiple thousands of footnotes. This is not that. This is a pamphlet in what I take to be an American tradition, a pamphlet which advocates action. It's normative. It's about what we should be able to do. It's an appeal to reason. It's an appeal to reason about the limits of our reason, which I take it is the essence of how our system is supposed to work. So I have a couple of ideas about democracy. I mean, my main idea about democracy is that I think it would be a really good thing, right? Like, I think aspirationally, I think democracy would be a really good thing. Like, I was looking at Tocqueville's Democracy in America the other week, and I was thinking about it the way, you know, Gandhi was thinking about Western civilization. I was thinking, yeah, that would be a really good thing, that democracy in America. I think it would be a really good thing. But the reason why democracy is so good is that it recognizes that we're all flawed. Because what an election does is it allows us to make mistakes, which we then blame on other people until we get to make mistakes again the next time. That is the beauty of democracy, that none of us is perfect, that we all make mistakes. But what democracy allows us to do is to keep the state going, keep the republic going, keep the country going, so that we can make mistakes again the next time, right? That's what it's all about. It's about the fact that none of us is perfect, which I take to be the principle around which our Constitution is written, and that's why the book starts with the Founding Fathers precisely. The main intuition of the Founding Fathers, and I will here put an asterisk by this and, you know, accept all possible criticisms of Founding Fathers, the main intuition which I think they have right is the inherent fallibility of all of us. And the way that you get around fallibility is that you set up institutions, you set up the branches of government, you set up the regular elections. You set these things up because you're skeptical of human nature. The Founding Fathers could not have been American exceptionalists because there was no America yet, right? So they weren't, to cut the story short. They did not think that we were going to be so wonderful that everything would naturally be good forever. They thought that their republic would very likely break down within a few decades, and I think, frankly, it's taken a lot of luck for that not to have been the case. What they left us with was the intuition that democracies and republics are likely to fail. Okay? That's where they start, and that's where we are. We are now in the basic historical reality that democracies and republics usually fail because our democracy and our republic, they are both failing. That is the historical norm. Now, what I do in the book is I add a couple of centuries of examples to what the Founding Fathers already knew. When the Founding Fathers were writing about the republic they imagined, they were thinking about Greek democracies, Athenian democracy. They were thinking about the Roman Republic, which of course became the Roman Empire. That's the kind of thing they were trying to head off. What I do in the book is I add a couple more centuries of examples, the couple centuries that we have and that they don't. And there's good news and bad news here. The bad news here is that in the intervening couple of centuries, many more democracies and republics have failed. The good news is that there's much more to learn from them, much more to learn from situations which are not so different from our own. The starting point I take is the same starting point I think that the Founding Fathers took, namely that we shouldn't assume that we're better than other people. We should assume that in similar situations we'll behave similarly. And therefore, the question is, what is the right kind of institution? How do we keep these kinds of institutions going? Which brings me to lesson number one. Lesson number one is the master lesson. It's the one that sounds the easiest and is maybe the hardest. It's the one which enables all of the others. So it's like an early departure point at this lecture, right? Like if you're looking for an excuse to get up, you can get up after number one. You can say, well, number one doesn't make any sense, or I think I blew number one already, and then you can just go, right? So number one, which nobody here did, I know, right? I can look you in the eye and I can say this with confidence, especially you. I mean, number one is don't obey in advance. Right? Don't obey in advance. And this is the kind of thing, maybe the most important thing that we get out of studying the 20th century and the rise of the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, the rise of the old-fashioned totalitarianisms. Don't obey in advance is the finding of historians about 1933. What don't obey in advance means is this, that there are forms of consent other than voting. Right? That there are forms of consent other than submission, that the most important forms of consent are somewhere in between choosing something and not choosing it. The forms of consent are things like looking away. The forms of consent are things like not reacting. The forms of consent are things like pretending that this is just normal, right? And that is so human. That is what we do. We normalize. And the moment that we start to normalize, here comes the moral punch. Once we say, well, this is normal, then we become the person who has said that this is normal. So a year on out, we are already at the point where certain figures in American public life are saying, it was okay that I didn't do anything for the previous year because really it's turned out that not so much has happened. An awful lot has happened. But if you don't act at the very beginning, it's very hard to act later on. Hence the don't obey in advance. Lesson number two is defend institutions, by which I mean a couple of things. The first thing I mean are the constitutional institutions, right? I mean, the example of the power of Congress to declare war, the constitutional power of the Congress to declare war, which has not been, you know, hasn't been exercised in many of our lifetimes, most of our lifetimes actually, even though we keep fighting wars, would indeed seem to be a rationally extended to the power to start a nuclear war. One can do an awful lot within the framework of the institutions as they already stand. But in the meantime, recognizing the institutions and supporting them is extremely important. But by institutions, I also mean the civil society organizations. We talk about, which it's important what civil society organizations do, for example, nuclear disarmament, but it's also important that they exist. They're a means to an end, but they're also an end in themselves. In the US, we talk about freedom of association, which is very important, but freedom is association. Freedom is association. It is impossible to be free by yourself. If you are by yourself, you are lonely, you feel abandoned, and you are easily overwhelmed. The Hollywood image of the one person who holds off, you know, you name it, the tank, the invasion, the fleet of space aliens, like, it's a great image. We love that image. You're down to your last, you know, down to your last person, and all they have, you know, they're wielding a catapult or whatever. But nevertheless, they manage to hold off, you know, the armies of the neighboring solar system. We love that. But that's not what freedom is really like. What freedom is really like is people feel free because they're around other people who are in some ways like them, in some ways different, but they're doing something together, right? So whether or not the institution succeeds, and some goals are very difficult, whether or not the institution succeeds, keeping institutions going is extremely important. Okay, so that was the first thing I wanted to talk about, what the book is. The second thing, where am I coming from? Where does this book come from? It comes from Europe, and it arrives here, right? It comes from the fact that I wrote, spent the last 25 years mainly learning languages, reading sources so that I could write about the Holocaust, so that I could write about Soviet terror, so I could write about the worst atrocities of the 20th century, which means that for me, the it in can it happen here is not a hypothetical or a fictional it. That's an it in which I live, right, mentally. The it of republics falling, atrocities happening, is I spent more time in that it than I spent in this very nice it in the last couple of decades. So I take for granted that the it can happen because of what I work on. Now, I work on those subjects, or I could work on those subjects, because I had teachers, many of them from Eastern Europe, most of whom had some contact with or grew up under communism, some of whom, as it turned out later, were survivors of the Holocaust. And from these people, something else came to me. It's so obvious and clear that it's barely a lesson, but I'll just say it out loud anyway, that the it happens to people like us, right? So that if I was taught by a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto, and I'm talking to you, that means we're all communicating with one another. It's all people like us. And then the third place this book is coming from is this. I'm not as old as you think I am, but I am old enough to have had, well, it's reached the point with my undergraduates, it's like, you know, it's like with kids, like you ask kids how old an adult is, and they're like, 150, right? Yeah. Okay. No, I mean, I remember the good old days when, like, I had seen the same movies as my undergraduates and things like that, right? Like that, okay, that's past. Although I can make cool Wonder Woman references. I'll try to work that in. Okay, so where was I? So I try to learn from my students, and because I work on East European history, many of my students are people who come from Russia or come from Ukraine or come from Poland. And if you think about their experience in life, if they're born in, say, 1989 or 1995 or 2000, their experience in life is not that, as was promised to them, freedom was going to approach them, right? The experience in most of Eastern Europe after 1989 has not been automatic freedom or ever-increasing freedom. If you were born in 89 or 95 or 2000 in Eastern Europe, the experience of your life has very likely been the opposite. It's very likely been the consolidation of wealth, very likely been the consolidation of authoritarian rule. And what that means is that I have things to learn from these people. So unfortunately, it's the case that a lot of my students now, like a lot of my teachers, have been in camps or have been tortured or, in a couple of cases, have been killed. And it is from those experiences that I'm trying to learn. Many of the lessons in this book, in fact, many of the terms in this book, come from people who are a generation or more younger than I am. So special welcome to you. It's especially important because it means, you know, the it can happen. The it can happen to people like us, and the it is already happening, right? The it is already happening. The specific reversal of the Western order that we take for granted, it was already happening before Mr. Trump was elected president of the United States. It was these same processes were already well underway. People were already engaging with them, and so we have things to learn from them. Which brings me to the third lesson, which is beware the one-party state. So, you know, depending upon your own political tastes and preferences, a one-party state might sound like bad fascism to you, or it might sound like bad communism to you. But let's just agree for the moment, provisionally, that a one-party state is not such a wonderful thing. The one-party state is on the way back. The one-party state is on the way back. And the way the one-party state is coming back in the 21st century is not by way of revolution. Nobody has to march on Rome anymore. Nobody has to carry out a revolution with an ideology anymore. Most of the time now when an authoritarian regime is founded, it's founded electorally. There's some election back there in the past, which was more or less fair, you know, like, I don't know, 2010 in, you know, the U.S. or whatever. There's an election somewhere in the past which is more or less fair, and then there's one which is a bit less fair. And then there was one which was a bit less fair. Then maybe there was one under conditions of emergency. And so slowly, step by step by step, you end up in a place where democracy is a sham and nobody believes in their own vote. But it's not clear exactly when that happened. And this is usually, you know, this is usually accompanied by the generation, you know, by variance on suppressing the vote. I mean, you know, like every family is unhappy in a different way, right, says Tolstoy. The vote is suppressed in different ways in every country. Like it reveals something about national style, how votes are suppressed, right, switching Russian authors. One way that votes are suppressed in Russia is that they add what are called dead souls, so votes that don't actually correspond to a living human being, right? That was a Gogol reference. They add that's specific to Russia, right? We don't, you know, we probably will start doing that sometime soon. But the point is that suppression of voting or manipulation of voting comes along with this territory. Another thing which comes along with this territory in the 21st century is political fiction. It's not political fiction of the old utopian kind. Right, nobody is promising socialist utopia. Nobody is promising fascist utopia, or not very many people anyway. What's being offered is a steady stream of stuff which is not only not true, but stuff which opens an aperture into an alternative reality, right? Creates a sort of fiction in which you can live, a fiction which makes you distrustful of other people who aren't living in your fiction. This is how it works in the 21st century. All of that was by way of lesson three, which is beware the one-party state. The one-party state is a temptation, right? Let's now put it graciously. It's a temptation to those who have perhaps more power than they ought to have electorally. It's a temptation. It's one that everyone has to watch out for. Okay, lesson four, take responsibility for the face of the world. Lesson five, remember professional ethics. Lesson six, be wary of paramilitaries. Lesson seven, be reflective if you must be armed. Lesson six and seven are about the practical side of regime change in the 30s and 40s. It's extremely important that the exercise of violence not escape the bounds of the state. That's how the Nazi transition took place, that paramilitaries blurred the boundary of what was unofficial and what was official violence. And I don't need to dwell on the details of what that would look like in the United States. On the other side, it's very important that official organs of violence, the police, the army, don't blur the boundaries going in the other direction, right? So these are obvious historical lessons. Lesson eight is stand out. Now, stand out is one that I don't have to dwell on in front of this group, but I'm going to anyway because I like it so much. Stand out is about how freedom is awkward. So, like, it's a little bit like peace. Like, peace is really hard work. Peace is really hard work. I mean, people who like violence think peace is the easy thing. No. Peace is the hard thing. Violence is the easy thing. Freedom is like that. People think freedom is easy because they think freedom is just kind of like saying the word freedom over and over again. Freedom is really hard. Standing out is hard. Doing the thing that's different from what everyone else is doing is difficult. In America, we think we're free when we're doing the stuff that everyone else is doing, and that's how the word freedom is used colloquially in America. The word free means you're doing the stuff other Americans are doing. That's what free means in American English. You're doing the same. But that's not what freedom really is. Freedom is that feeling of awkwardness. It's that feeling of doing something that maybe you shouldn't be doing because not everyone else is doing it. And if one doesn't have that feeling, then one is not, I'm convinced, a free person. Right? That's what standing out means. So, all right. So that's lesson eight. Third thing I wanted to talk about: what do I think is happening? Okay. Now, I will very happily get as deep into the details of the present day as you want. But what I want to do in questions, but what I want to do here is just give a kind of general overview and introduce some concepts that maybe are useful. I think what is happening is that we're shifting from a politics of inevitability to a politics of eternity. So I'm a historian, I think everything is about time, so bear with me. I think there are basically three kinds of politics that are at work: politics of inevitability, politics of eternity, and politics of responsibility. Politics of inevitability is the idea that we know what the future is going to be, we just have to push a few buttons. So for example, you'll get it if I put it like this. A right-wing version of the politics of inevitability says nature brings the market brings democracy, so there's nothing to worry about. There are no alternatives, right? As Maggie Thatcher put it, there are no alternatives. That's the politics of inevitability. There's also a left-wing version. You know, there are many left-wing versions, but a left-wing version would be something like, the arc of history is long, but bends towards justice. I mean, I wish that were true. It's beautiful, but it's not. There is no arc. It doesn't bend. It's all down to us, really. So the politics of inevitability is breaking. It's breaking in the U.S. It's breaking for a number of reasons. The most obvious one is inequality. If you don't think you have a future, it's very hard to believe in a story about how things are obviously getting better. The politics of inevitability, the story of progress, breaks down individual by individual, family by family, Appalachian Valley by Appalachian Valley. The people who won the election for Mr. Trump were people who lived in counties in the Midwest, which are in public health crisis and which are in opioid crisis. That is, the places in the United States where, not the only places, but places in the United States where the story of progress just doesn't make sense anymore, especially to people who were used to taking it for granted. Now, what happens when an inevitability story breaks down is that an eternity story comes to take its place. An eternity story is not about how the future is always going to be better. It's about how the same thing happens over and over again. The same thing happening over and over again is that the malevolent outsider is attacking the innocent us. That's the story. So the way that the politics of eternity works is that it banishes the future completely. It doesn't talk about how to make a better future. Instead, it talks about making America great again, right? It loops back into the past. It loops back, but it doesn't actually ask what was better about the past. So in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, the distribution of American wealth was much more even than it is now. No one's talking about that. Unions were a lot stronger than they are now. No one's talking about that. American public education, at least in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, was the best or close to the best in the world. It's not now. No one's talking about that. Right? There are things about making America great or about the decades that people remember that one could actually apply public policy to. That's not what you do in the politics of eternity. You don't do any public policy. What you do instead is you refer to a past in which you think you were relatively better off than someone else. Right, so you tell the making America great again is not about actually doing the things that might make America more just and therefore more hopeful. It's about telling some Americans that they're better than other Americans. Right, that's the way that it works. You politics, instead of being about a future which is common, is about a present in which Americans are broken up into different clans and are at constant war with each other. Right, so hence references to. You know, the list just always forgets something, but the hateful references to Native Americans, African Americans, immigrants, Muslims, you name it, right? That's not random or baffling. It is part of a policy, which is to tell some Americans that you're better Americans, some Americans that you're worse Americans, and then the politics of eternity will just let you fight it out, fight it out, fight it out, fight it out, until everyone forgets about the future, which, by the way, has already happened. Right. I mean, how many people, whether you're Republicans or Democrats or, you know, whatever else you might be, believe that there will be future-oriented public policy? No one believes in that. I mean, people might disagree about whether that's good or bad, but nobody thinks there's actually going to be public policy made in the next 4 years, and there will not. It goes a bit deeper than that. The politics of eternity in its extreme variant takes the pain that brought it about and makes that pain worse. So consider this hypothetically. Consider hypothetically that the main problem in your country was inequality. And consider hypothetically that there's a group of people who suffer in public health crisis. So what policies would you make? Well, would you take away their health care? And would you push tax regression so that wealth is even more concentrated in the top? It's not even 1%, you know, actually. It's the top 0.01%. Would you push a tax plan which further concentrates wealth? Yes, you would, because the idea is to generate pain. Because the pain that you generate with public policy then becomes the energy that you divert, the energy that you use to keep one set of people fighting with another set of people. That's how the politics of eternity works. Insofar as there is public policy, it's meant to hurt your supporters. Deliberately to hurt your supporters, which, you know, that's pretty much where we are. The policy that is available, either it won't happen, in which case people can say government can't do anything, or if it does happen, it will administer pain, and that pain then becomes the fuel for the story. Okay, politics of responsibility. This is the hopeful part. Politics of responsibility has to do with understanding where we are in history, what is actually possible and taking responsibility for trying to make certain things happen. So the bulk of the book is about the kind of politics of responsibility, what one can actually do. And many of you are doing these things, so you know, just please take these as my concepts and my encouragement. Lesson number 9 is be kind to the language. Lesson number 10 is believe in truth. Lesson number 11 is investigate. This business of truth is extremely important. Okay, I talked earlier about like how freedom is awkward. One thing which is always just a little bit awkward for me is to stand up as a historian and say, believe in truth, because it's like a dentist standing up and saying, oral hygiene is really important. You know, like it's right down the middle of what we do, but it's like so central and, you know, so axiomatic that's just a little tiny bit embarrassing. But honestly, I'm not embarrassed to talk about it, because without the truth, without the pursuit of the truth, pretty much every institution that we take for granted becomes impossible. It's not that we have to agree about what the truth is. That's different. We just have to agree that it's there. If we don't think there's any truth, if we really reach the point where I just say, well, like, Stanley has his thing and I've got my thing and it doesn't really matter who's right, when you reach that point, civil society is impossible. Because you cannot cooperate with people unless you trust them, and you can't trust them unless there's some world in which you trust them, some real world. The rule of law is impossible. The rule of law depends on findings of fact. Any of you out there who are thinking about the Mueller thing, right, which I'm happy to talk about, the rule of law depends on findings of fact. If we get to a place where the FBI has its opinion and like the Supreme Court justice has his opinion, but on the other hand, you know, I've got my opinion, if we get to that place, the rule of law is impossible. If we get to the place where we just all think all that matters is our subjective opinions and we're not going to look and try to figure things out, we will then be lonely. Because what are we going to talk to? And of course, we've already progressed a very long way in this direction. How can we talk to each other? We will all be lonely, and we will all, therefore, be powerless. And what wins in this situation, and this is not my speculating, this is what the 21st century looks like, what wins in that situation is spectacle. Fact is our only defense against spectacle. Money will always have the spectacle. There are people who can make a better spectacle. I mean, much as I hope you're enjoying this, there are better spectacles than listening to some guy talk in front of a microwave, and whether it's a microphone, you know, whatever this thing is. There are better spectacles than that, and there are better unintentional jokes than that. There's always a bigger spectacle, right? There's always something that can be more spectacular. And if we drop the factual, what we accept is the spectacular. Then we get convinced by the spectacular, which that's the way Russia works now, right? And that is the way the United States is beginning to work. It's the spectacular, and it's the deep pockets which will always have the better spectacle. So if you give up on the facts, you're basically saying, oligarchy, come to us. Please, that's what we want. We want the oligarchy. Number 12, make eye contact and small talk. So this is maybe the one which has gotten the most response, the eye contact and the small talk. Since I'm here, I'm gonna quote scripture. Watch this. Paul, 1 Corinthians, right, 13, the through a glass darkly quotation, right? That's what this is all about. You know as you are known, right? If you don't talk to other people, if you don't let them know you, then you only know in part. You only know the whole if you see how other people see you. And you can't do that over the goddamn internet, right? It just cannot be done. It doesn't happen. No one on Facebook ever writes back, right, you have convinced me with your thoroughly rational arguments, right? Of the trillions of Facebook posts, that one has never actually been written, right? The only way to know yourself is to catch a glimpse of yourself in someone else's eyes. And that can only be done in person, right? So to make eye contact and small talk is in the book because I think it's very important for us to have the conversations, even if we don't persuade other people. Because it's not about the instant gratification. It's not about, you know, finding that person who voted a different way than we did and immediately convincing them. Because that, of course, never happens. And that's not what it's about, right? Think about the last time you argued with the person you're closest to. Did you convince them in one conversation? No. So why should it happen with a stranger in Mississippi? It's not going to. The important thing is establishing that you're a human being. which cannot be done over the internet. And the important thing also is seeing yourself through their eyes, because only when you see yourself through their eyes can you see what you might be right about and might be wrong about, because often the other person is right about something. You never see that unless you see yourself the way that they see you. Okay, I really like 1 Corinthians 13, so I'll just move on now. But thank you for the opportunity to do 1 Corinthians 13. I appreciate that. Number 13 is related. Practice corporeal politics. You all know about this because you're here. Getting your body out from the house, out from the computer, in among other bodies, what you're doing now. Number 14, establish a private life. Also very similar, but what I mean by that is don't shed everything onto the internet. Keep some part of you, which is just you. Number 15, contribute to good causes, which can mean time and energy. It can also mean money. A very easy fix is just to, like, and I'm sure a number of you have done this, but like just set a bunch of things to auto pay. And then, like, no matter how bad of a day you're having, you're helping a bunch of other good people do good things, right? Do that with newspapers too, please. It makes such a difference. Then number 16, learn from peers in other countries. Okay. What comes next? Where are we heading? Where do I think we're going? So I'll just say a few things here. We'll talk about it more. But I think elections, right? Very important. Some elections can't afford to lose. Elections necessary but not sufficient. Can't put all, got to win them, but that's not enough. It can't depend entirely on a political party. This is a very long-term transformation that we're facing one way or another. The rule of law, extremely important as a principle. Easy to let go. So with the Mueller thing, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, the main thing that signifies for me is the rule of law. Findings of fact and the application of the rule of law. That's what's holding the United States together at this point. It's not the checks and balances, which, sorry to say, are not really working. But the thing that we're hanging on to by our teeth or our fingernails or whatever, like, desperate anatomical metaphor you prefer, is the rule of law. That's the thing that we've still got. Thank you. And I didn't even tell you about my high school football knee injury, which... which is fictional. Okay, so rule of law. Where we already are, I've talked about this before, but where we already are is the production of fiction, the endless production of fiction. So on the one side, you feel outraged, right? I mean, every few days, every few minutes, every few hours, you feel outraged. Okay, I finally got you nodding. All right, you guys haven't been big nodders so far, but thank you for nodding at the outrage, right? So you feel outraged, but for every time you feel outraged, someone else feels triumph. And that's the way the dialectic works, the outrage versus the triumph versus the outrage versus the triumph. And that's where the energy goes and where it's meant to go. Some Americans versus other Americans, as opposed to people thinking about their interests and what public policy they should have, or people thinking about what public policy they want or how to cooperate. We're meant to be outraged. That's part of how it's supposed to work. And the way that collapses everything into the present, that makes it very hard to think about the future, which is why I started by affirming the climate change and by affirming the nuclear weapons, because there are these long-term things that we can't give up on. We can't give up on those things. We have to be thinking about the future. If we drop down into the present and we just fight the fight, then we're going to lose. Then we lose, because that's the politics of eternity. You get swept into this thing, into this cycle, and you just go round and round and round again. You get swept into the news cycle, basically. It's like the news cycle is a centrifuge or something, and you just get whipped around with it over and over and over and over and over. And you're protesting, you know? You've got your back against the wall in that centrifuge, and you're, like, pushing your fingers out away from the centrifuge. That's not enough. We have to try to stay out of that. The other thing which is going on, which is getting worse, is the transmission of fiction. And by fiction, I don't just mean things that aren't true. I mean, there are a lot of things that aren't true, like my high school football injury. But by fiction, I mean fiction is not just an untruth. An untruth is something you could apologize for, right? You could say, so it's critical that the President of the United States never apologizes for an error. That's so you're moving out of the Enlightenment into something else. And in enlightened politics, or enlightened anything, you make a mistake, you recognize that there's a mistake made, and you apologize for it. You issue a correction. And when you issue the correction, you're accepting that there is a real world out there. When it's not just that you lie systematically, it's that you never apologize for it. That's the most important thing. Because what you're trying to engender is a world of fiction in which there isn't actually truth or factuality as a check. That's the important thing. The living in the world where it just isn't clear if there is anything that's true or not, right? And there are some real pioneers, you know, in that. And one of them is in the Oval Office. That's where we are. Let me close with the prediction part by talking about Russia. So one of the things that people ask me about a lot is how to think about Russia. Like on the one hand, did they interfere and change the outcome of our elections? On the other hand, isn't it all our fault? And I say, we don't have to choose, right? Probably their interference did change the outcome of the election. But the only reason why it was so close in the first place had to do with problems in our own political system, in our own society. And the thing, the really shocking thing, I think, the really shocking thing is this. It worked better than they thought it was going to work because we are much more like them than anybody thought. That's the lesson. That, for example, if you look at, I'll just take the most basic primitive level thing. If you look at levels of economic inequality, there is only one country which is giving Russia a run for its money right now, and that's the United States of America. Right. There's only one country which is making a run at Russia for how much wealth is concentrated in the top 1%, top 0.1%, top 0.01%, and that is the United States of America. I can develop the argument out from there, but that's the basic thing. The fiction worked better on us because we are more like them than we think we are, which means that we should think about Russia, I think, not so much as this. It is a hostile force trying to destroy us, but that's not the most useful way to think about it. The most useful way to think about Russia today is that's what a political fiction-producing oligarchy looks like. If you see it that way, then you can learn a little bit what to guard against. Okay, so that's so much, okay, I don't want to say so much for the future because the whole point of the talk is that there is a future, that a politics of responsibility is happening. But the last few lessons are about how to head off the most dangerous conjunctions. They are lesson 17, listen for dangerous words. The dangerous words are terrorism and extremism. Emergency is another good one. These are the words that are used to signal a regime change. Something happens, doesn't happen, maybe happens. State of emergency, have to do something about the extremism. In the 21st century, it's usually extremism. There's some law that's passed against extremism where extremism is never carefully defined. Extremism can be anything. You were all definitely extremists, by the way. You were all extremists. You were definitely all extremists. In terms of the kinds of laws that are on the books now about extremism, we are all extremists. Terrorism is another good one in the 21st century. Not that it's not a real thing in the world, of course it is, but it's used as a justification for changing regimes. That's lesson 17, is listen for those words. Lesson 18, be calm when the unthinkable arrives. This is the one that I've been repeating over and over again, trying to make it a self-defeating prophecy, because the way that the Reichstag fire works in Germany in 1933... the lesson that is page one on the authoritarian playbook, which is available at Amazon for $4.99, that's also not true. Okay, but the on page one of the authoritarian playbook is Reichstag fire, and Reichstag fire means there's some kind of act of terrorism. It's unclear where it came from, who did it. You declare a state of emergency. You end a republic. You start something else. The state of emergency, which was declared in Germany in 1933, lasts until 1945. Right. One act of terror, how do you respond? How does the government respond is one question. The meaningful question is, how do we respond? And if we know that there's a politics to this, that an act of terror, or for that matter, an aggressive war that we start, or a defensive war that we're in, whatever it is, some exceptional moment, there is a politics to this. And the politics is that the head of state says, this is so exceptional that I need you to accept that your rights are going to be suspended for a moment. And that's the moment where you act or you lose everything. So that's lesson 18. Lesson 19 is be a patriot. And I'm just going to read a little bit from this one. The distinction I'm trying to make in Lesson 19, I'm not going to read Lesson 20 because I think Lesson 20 is a good one to read by yourself. But the point I'm trying to make in Lesson 19 is the difference between patriotism and nationalism, which has a lot to do with the difference between the politics of eternity and what I'm calling the politics of responsibility. Nationalism is the politics of eternity. It says all that ever happens is that those bad outsiders come to try to take our national innocence away. And that just happens over and over and over again. We're the greatest thing in the world, not because of anything we've done. We just are. And let me tell it to you over and over and over and over again, that we just are the best. That's nationalism. Patriotism is something a little bit different, or I would say actually a lot different. I'm just going to close with a few sentences from the book about this. So, a nationalist encourages us to be our worst and then tells us that we are the best. A nationalist, quote, although endlessly brooding on power, victory, defeat, revenge, wrote Orwell, tends to be, quote, uninterested in what happens in the real world, unquote. Nationalism is relativist, since the only truth is the resentment we feel when we contemplate others. As the novelist Danilo Kiš put it, nationalism, quote, has no universal values, aesthetic or ethical. A patriot, by contrast, wants the nation to live up to its ideals, which means asking us to be our best selves. A patriot must be concerned with the real world, which is the only place where his country can be loved and sustained. A patriot has universal values, standards by which he judges his nation, always wishing it well and wishing that it would do better. Democracy failed in Europe in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and it is failing not only in much of Europe, but in many parts of the world today. It is that history and experience that reveals to us the dark range of our possible futures. A nationalist will say, it can't happen here, which is the first step toward disaster. A patriot says, it could happen here, but that we will stop it. Thank you very much.
Professor Wheeler, how would you assess the effectiveness of the quote-unquote resistance so far? And do you see in its architecture the potential to actually overcome the tyranny that you've spoken about?
Well, the first thing to say is that the thing that we would call the resistance has a lot of different parts, and that's a very good thing. Marching is important. Neighborhood groups are important. Doctors are important, lawyers are important, investigative reporters are important, people talking to their congressmen and senators, very important. It's important that the variety of American life is represented in the variety of what we're calling the resistance. There isn't just one resistance. There are a whole lot of people approaching this problem in different ways. The second thing to say is that if it weren't for that, things would be unimaginably worse than they are right now. If it weren't for the thing that was called the resistance, I think legally the position of American citizens and non-citizens would be a lot worse right now. If it weren't for the investigative reporters, I think we'd be much, much closer to losing the rule of law than we are right now. And we would know nothing about important things like the Russian investigation, right? So the thing we take for granted where we are, but we're only where we are. It's not as bad as it could be because of things that have already happened in the last year. The third thing to say is that it's partly about stopping, but it's also partly about preparing. That Trump is a significant problem in and of himself. A president who doesn't care about the basic traditions of a rule of law society is a problem. But he's the president of the United States for reasons which go beyond himself. And resisting Mr. Trump is largely about creating the kinds of citizens who can build a better United States of America at the end of it, right? And that's one of the reasons why it's important that people continue to resist, continue to do the things they do regularly, every day, with people they know, with people they don't know, because it's about making us ready for the point. We don't know when it's going to come, but making us ready for the point when this particular problem is no longer present, but when the underlying problems remain.
And then a follow-up to that, you mentioned like a critical event, a foreign war, or a terrorist attack, domestic terrorist attack, that could be the sort of the tripwire that would plunge us into a real authoritarian nightmare. What kind of action could forestall that?
The answer is already in the question. The main thing is to understand that terrorist attacks or other surprises are historically used by aspiring authoritarians to change democratic regimes into non-democratic regimes. Once you know that, then you can prepare yourself not to give in to your own shock and grief, not to allow the president or anyone else to say our rights have to be suspended now. They don't. Fighting terrorism is not about changing the country to an authoritarian regime. If we know that there's a politics to all of this, then we can prepare ourselves for it, and we can say ahead of time, as much as we would like to work against terrorism, we are not prepared to change the constitutional structure of the country. If we're aware of this and if we say this openly, then we're doing the thing that we can do.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.